This podcast is not legal advice and should not be relied upon as such. You should always obtain legal advice about your specific circumstances.
Hello, and welcome to our latest season of Tax Records, the Hall & Wilcox Tax Team's podcast series. In this series, we are looking at the ever-important topic of M&A. And in particular, in a two-part series, we started by talking through the basics of an M&A deal. And in this episode today, we are going to be talking through some of the tax elements of an M&A deal. And I'm delighted today to be joined by my colleague, Michael Parker. Michael is a fellow tax partner in the Hall & Wilcox tax team, and we've worked together for a very, very long time. And I regard Michael as a premier tax lawyer in Australia, especially on all of the issues that affect SMEs, private business, and high wealth individuals. And relevantly for us today on M&A transactions in particular, and Michael in the last 6 months has had a direct involvement on some very significant private business M&A transactions, and is eminently qualified to talk to us about this topic today. So Michael, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Thanks, Frank. Always good to chat.
So, Michael, on our previous podcast with James, we discussed the importance of preparation and of getting one's house in order as the first step in carrying out an M&A deal. Now, in a lot of the deals that we see, especially in the private and family-owned business segment, and especially when we're acting for the seller, it's often the case that there will be financial relationships between the business entities and the shareholders or the principals of that business. A classic example that we would see all the time is shareholder loans or intergroup funding arrangements. So, Michael, in your experience, what are some of the key things that clients should focus on when getting their house in order from a tax perspective before embarking on an M&A deal?
Well, Frank, you're right. I think increasingly we're seeing sale transactions where people are preferring to sell or buy, for that matter, shares in companies or even units in trusts is starting to creep in. And typically, where it is a share sale or a unit sale, the terms of the deal will be on a cash-free, debt-free basis. And what that means is that the purchaser doesn't want to take anything other than essentially the business assets that the company or trust needs to continue carrying on its business. And they want to make sure that private assets, things like shareholder loans, in or out for that matter, are removed from the balance sheet. So what often happens as a part of a precursor to a sale is that we need to remove things like surplus cash, private assets, loans to shareholders from out of the target entity. And we've got to be cautious that that in itself can trigger some potential tax liabilities. For instance, the company or trust that's transferring the assets might have a CGT event, or if it's a depreciable asset that's being transferred, it might just be not CGT, but a balancing adjustment under the depreciation regime that applies. So there can be implications for the company or the trust that's the target of the transaction. Typically, those transactions are done, on a non-arm's length basis. So market value substitution rules would typically apply also, even if market value proceeds are not being provided back to the company, and in many cases they won't be. That also raises the point, though, that if assets are being transferred, particularly out of a private company to the shareholders or associates of the shareholders, that can trigger an actual dividend or even a deemed dividend under Division 7A. So we just need to be aware of that. Typically, we can manage those sort of things in the sense that if the vendors are aware that there's a liability, well, they factor that into the transaction, whether they want to go ahead with the transaction. But it's best that they're aware of it rather than sneaking up after the fact and turning into an issue where they say, oh, I wouldn't have gone ahead with the deal if I'd known I had all of these other tax implications, emanating from restructuring. I mentioned also that sometimes we have loans into a company. So there might be shareholder or director loans that have been made to the company. And again, where it's a cash-free, debt-free basis, the purchaser is going to want to make sure that they are typically cleared before they buy the company. And if the company doesn't have available cash or other means to repay those related party debts, liabilities, then there can be a tendency to think, let's just look at forgiving them. And I always think you've just got to be a bit mindful that there are some tax implications of forgiving debts. And one of those is the potential for the commercial debt forgiveness rules to apply. And if those rules apply, they can have the effect, quite an adverse effect, of reducing or even eliminating some of the tax attributes of the target company, such as its tax losses and even the cost base of some of its assets, which would be typically something that would upset a purchaser who's thinking that they're buying potentially the company with those attributes in place. What we find in practice where the company hasn't got the ability to pay out related party loans, so shareholder loans into the company, is that it can sometimes be a better outcome if we actually reduce the sale price of the shares and request that the purchaser inject some further funds into the company once they take ownership of it. And that allows the company to then repay those shareholder loans rather than having them forgiven or released and causing a tax problem. And typically speaking, if it is a shareholder loan, the receipt of that by the lender will more often than not be tax-free. So it tends to be a good outcome.
Excellent. And I think you and I both know that in the practical world, commercial people or the owners of the business and the potential purchaser discuss and negotiate these things commercially and sometimes agree on the price, but haven't exactly got all of these tax nuances in mind. And there can oftentimes be a bit of catching up to do on these things. So that's some excellent information there. Now, Parky, again, on our previous podcast, we talked about, you know, how a M&A deal tends to kick off, and very often an M&A deal kicks off by the signing of a term sheet or a heads of agreement. And then, again, this is often a product of the discussions and the negotiations of the commercial people behind the deal, and lawyers and certainly tax advisors may not be involved at that early stage. So we know that simple capital gains tax 101 is that the date of the CGT event happens at the date of contract, not necessarily on the date of settlement, which a lot of people might think is the case. So if we do have a client who is about to or has entered into a term sheet or a heads of agreement, then what are some of the key tax considerations that have to be thought about and managed at this early stage?
Well, you're right, Frank, that the CGT event will be when the contract is entered into, even though an event actually doesn't happen until change of ownership. But once that change of ownership occurs, the event is taken back to be the time of entering the contract. So the big question then becomes, well, when did we enter into a contract? And there's been some AAT cases in fairly recent time that has considered that question and looked at circumstances where parties believed that the CGT event, the entering into the contract, was when a formal contract was entered into, but the tribunal looked and determined that the parties had entered into heads of agreements or term sheets that actually pretty much encompassed all of the terms of the agreement and were found to be effectively binding on the parties, such that the tribunal said, really, your contract goes back to when you entered into the heads of agreement or the term sheet, not when you subsequently entered into a formal contract. And that can have some pretty dire outcomes from a tax perspective. I mean, most basically, it might mean that a taxpayer has brought forward a CGT event to an earlier year than they anticipated. So they might, for instance, sign a heads of agreement this side of 30 June and a contract's not signed until well into the next financial year, and the taxpayer goes off on their merry way thinking CGT event's not until 2024, let's say, and they budget accordingly that they won't have to pay tax until 24 or possibly even 25 when they lodge their 24 tax return. And they can get a nasty shock if it's determined that there was actually a contract entered into in the earlier year when they signed up to a heads of agreement or a term sheet. So that's a fairly simple example of where it can cause a nasty outcome. It can also create problems for taxpayers who are hoping to get access to the 50% CGT discount. It's a requirement of that discount that the CGT event occurs at least 12 months after the asset was acquired by the vendor. And again, you might find a situation where the contract is entered into beyond the 12-month period, but the effect of an earlier heads of agreement or term sheet might mean that the CGT event was actually at an earlier point in time and within 12 months of acquiring the asset, in which case you wouldn't get access to the 50% discount. And importantly, it can also have an impact for accessing the CGT small business concessions. And indeed, that's what happened with the AOT decisions that I've referred to. In those cases, the taxpayers thought they were eligible for the CGT concessions based on the net asset value just before they signed the contract of sale. And bearing in mind that when you're determining if you're eligible for the small business CGT concessions, you need to satisfy that 6 million test just before the CGT event. So you measure your CGT assets, net assets, just before that event. Now, in these cases, the taxpayers thought that they needed to measure it before they signed the formal contract, and they met the condition, only to find out that the relevant CGT event was actually when they signed the heads of agreement. And at that point in time, their assets were considerably over the 6 million test. So it can have that ability to knock you out of accessing the small business concessions. Also, just on the topic of the small business CGT concessions, there are other tests that sometimes need to be met that look at the relevant year in which the CGT event occurred. So, for instance, if you're using one of the concessions that requires a significant individual or a CGT concession stakeholder to be in existence in the relevant income year, then you might have, for instance, if you've got trusts involved, made sure that the trust distributed income in certain proportions to achieve that for the relevant year. Now, if you then find out that the CGT event was actually in an earlier year when you hadn't done your distributions in the right proportions, again, it might mean that you're no longer going to access the tests for the small business CGT concessions.
So those are all some really good points there, Parky. And as we know, in tax, timing can be everything, and especially the timing of a contract of sale. So if we were to pretend you were Moses for a moment, if you had four commandments about what a term sheet or heads of agreement should or should not say, what would those be?
Well, number one, I would always include something saying, quite explicitly saying that the heads of agreement or the term sheet is not intended to create any legally binding obligations other than perhaps for certain terms such as exclusivity and confidentiality. And typically we would want some confidentiality clauses in play that would be binding. But other than that, I want to make it expressly state that it's not otherwise intended to create legally binding obligations. Secondly, I would try and include something to the effect that the document, the heads of agreement, term sheet, whatever it is not a commitment to proceed with the proposed transaction. Thirdly, that the parties are still in the course of negotiations, and that will typically be the case, but why not express it in the term sheet itself that quite explicitly state that the parties are still in the course of negotiation? A fourth and final, I would include something saying that no obligation arises under the agreement or the term sheet until formal agreements are prepared and signed that set out the terms and conditions and any additional understandings that have been developed throughout the course of negotiation of the transaction.
Brilliant. Well, let's set those in stone and make sure everybody pays attention. And again, just to emphasise the point, all of this is oftentimes happening at a stage when there may not be legal advisors involved and more often there may not be tax advisors involved. So all of the points that you've discussed are very important ones, and you've illustrated very well how this seemingly minor question of timing can change and affect tax outcomes very materially and sometimes very adversely for the affected party. So some really important points there. And sticking with this sort of early stage when, you know, the deal is being formulated, Michael, it is, again, often at this early time or the early stage of a deal when some key decisions may be made about the way that a deal should be structured. For example, should it be a sale of shares versus a sale of a business? Or the structure of the target entity itself might become a sticking point between the seller and the buyer. I mean, and you and I both have a lot of experience. In Australia, running a business or a trust is very common. But overseas, when you're trying to explain, A, what a trust is, and B, the fact that a trust is carrying on a business, you can certainly run into a bit of a lost in translation issue and some resistance in terms of transacting with a trust. So it's common to have a pre-sale restructure, but before doing that or before thinking about that, what are some of the key issues and some of the key risks that need to be managed?
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, one of the things that might be required is shifting assets out of a structure. For instance, if we've got a pre-existing company that we wish to sell, it might involve transferring non-sale assets, private assets, excess cash, et cetera, out of the company. And that can cause, obviously, potential liabilities for the company itself if the assets being transferred have gone up in value over and above their cost base. But it can also cause potential dividends, either actual dividends if the recipient is a shareholder, or deemed dividends if it's a shareholder or their associate. And so there can be those tax complications or implications, I should say, from shifting assets out of a structure. Always bear in mind, and it can sometimes, I think, be a bit of a blind spot for people, we get so focused on the income tax aspects and the capital gains tax aspects and Division 7A and things like that, that it's easy to lose sight of other taxes. If you're shifting assets around, there could be GST implications. And then most importantly, perhaps it could also give rise to unexpected duty liabilities in various states and territories. And the rules in each of those states and territories differ. So it's just something to be mindful of, that transferring assets or even transferring shares and units, et cetera, in entities can be a dutiable transaction. And the last thing you want to have is a transaction proceed, and there's a duty liability that no one expected, and the taxpayer turns around and says, "Oh, I wouldn't have done the transaction if I'd known there was this huge duty implication. I'm going to have a go at the advisors and try and recover some costs under a PI claim." Consideration also should be given, if you're doing any sort of restructuring pre-sale, to whether the general anti-avoidance provisions can apply. They have been run up the flagpole, certainly by the tax office, and I understand from ATO publications that they have some significant concerns, particularly where there's back-to-back rollovers used as a precursor to a sale. So, for instance, if you mentioned, a trust owning assets, and let's say the purchaser is a company and the sale proceeds are to be partially or wholly scrip in the purchaser entity, then there's an incentive, if you like, to try and get a deferral under the scrip for scrip rollover provisions. But if the trust were to roll its assets into a wholly owned company and it can get a CGT rollover for that, that means there's no tax on that transaction. If it then subsequently transfers the shares in that newly acquired company to the purchaser in exchange for scrip, it would appear that you get a second rollover and we just sort of get a deferral of the taxing point. But I understand the ATO would take issue with that potentially and look to apply the general anti-avoidance rules to annihilate the tax benefit. So something to be mindful of, particularly where rollovers are being used as part of a pre-sale restructure.
No, some very important points, Michael, and we're being constantly and consistently cautioned by the ATO. And also, we're seeing Part 4A become a feature in a number of decisions, including Guardian AIT, which will be the subject of one of our podcasts in this series. Some very, very important points there, and a pre-sale restructure should always be done with a lot of care, with a lot of planning, and with consideration to the general anti-avoidance provisions. Now, Michael, again, on our last podcast with James, he walked us through the due diligence process, and we tried to demystify this very jargon, this little bit of legal jargon for our audience. And you and I both have experience that in, you know, going through a due diligence process or preparing for a due diligence process, that getting your house in order factor, that you can in that process bring up and shed some light on some historical tax exposures. And sometimes they can be very material ones, and they can become very material issues in a deal, if not deal breakers. So if we have a client, they have gone through this process or are about to go through this process, and they do uncover a historical tax issue or an exposure, what's your experience and what are some of the strategies that you've used to manage these risks and to try to not derail the deal?
Well, as a starting point, I find it's best to be upfront with the purchaser if, for instance, we're acting for the sellers and we've identified a risk or a perceived risk, potential risk. It's better to be upfront, reveal it to the purchaser and suggest a plan for dealing with it. And that plan might be as simple as agreeing with the purchaser that a ruling will be sought. Private ruling will be sought to get certainty on what the outcome is, whether there is an issue or whether we're jumping at shadows. And in the meantime, the deal can proceed on the basis that the purchaser will hold some of the sale proceeds back in escrow, only to be released in the event that there's clearance given by the relevant revenue authority, whether it's the ATO or a state revenue office. So that can be a useful way to do things. Interestingly, when dealing with large listed companies, quite often they will have a policy in place where it's incumbent upon them to reveal or raise with the tax office any tax risks that they find when they've purchased a new subsidiary. So it's not a case of possibly being revealed to the tax office. They will have an actual policy where they will proactively go to the tax office and say, we've acquired a subsidiary, we've identified this issue. Now, what do you want us to do about it? Is there a risk? Do we need to pay some back taxes? Whatever it happens to be. And again, the way to deal with that typically is to be upfront with the purchaser, agree what the course of action will be, whether it's them making a voluntary disclosure to the tax office or seeking a ruling, but in the meantime, proceeding with the transaction on the basis that some of the sale proceeds will be held back in escrow by the purchaser and only released in the event that they get either clearance from the tax office. If they don't get that clearance, well, the proceeds will be applied to reduce the tax debt that the subsidiary needs to pay. Another thought And we're seeing it increasingly gaining in popularity is to look at whether there's an ability to get any warranty insurance to cover potential risks from a tax point of view. It can be pricey, and it might mean having to go over to foreign insurers and go to London, et cetera. But we're seeing that increasingly come into play in transactions.
Okay, everyone. So we're going to leave part one there and pick up on our discussion with Michael Parker in part two. As always, if this podcast raises any questions for you, then please feel free to get in touch. All of our details are available on the Hall & Wilcox website, which is www.hallandwilcox.com.au, or connect with us or Hall & Wilcox on LinkedIn. And if you enjoyed today's episode, and I have no doubt that you would have, then please rate, review, or follow our podcast wherever you choose to get your podcasts. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to bringing you part two very, very soon.